Welcome to our continuing podcast series from IFR Magazine for February 2008. Here's IFR editor Jeff Van West.
We're talking with Paul Burge. These days, Paul can be found on Iowa Public TV or terrorizing tailwheel students and Iowa farmers alike with his Marquardt Charger biplane and Aronca Champ. But Paul is also the former editor of IFR Magazine and a former air traffic controller. Paul, air traffic control is an odd mix of an impersonal relationship, you know, where people are literally numbers moving around a screen, and a very personal one-to-one relationship. What are some of the personal moments that stand out for you?
It is indeed odd, but I'm glad you said personal, because like when I worked here at Des Moines, I used to work out in Monterey as well. But when you're working in an approach control, you tend to learn a lot of the pilots' names by their call sign, and by walking around the ramp, you meet people. And I remember two in particular. There's a pilot in Des Moines. His name is Wayne, and he flies corporate, does flies everything. And years ago, he was flying, I think it was a charter in a Seneca, and we had a line of Iowa thunderstorms coming through, like a squall line. And I was working radar. And just this nasty line, this is before we had ASR-9, I think we're using ASR-3, so we're looking at pretty much raw radar return. And he was handed off to me from center, and he was on the west side of this line trying to come through it. And the line stretched from, you know, the North Pole down to Mexico. And he checked on, and he had a storm scope probably. And Justin, I could tell his voice, I knew him that well, that he was looking at some nasty stuff. And he asked me, in a first-name basis, what do you see, Paul? And I told him what I see on the scope, and I'm working the gain up and down, trying to get a picture of this thing. And I gave him what alleyways I saw, and him using his storm scope and his eyeballs, he picked his way through this thing. And he picked his way through it without hardly a bump. And it was just one of those wonderful moments where, yeah, it worked, but more importantly, this was a friend of mine going through there. And yeah, your heart's in your throat at that point when you're doing that. And there was another guy, I forget his name, we just call him Fearless, and he flew a Cherokee of some kind. He got his instrument rating, private pilot, and he had an Archer, and he flew all the time IFR, just a great guy. But he flew probably a little bit beyond his capabilities, and one night I was working, it was a winter night, and it was just crummy IFR, ice everywhere, and, you know, the freight dogs were loading up, and I get this handoff in the center on this Cherokee coming into this satellite airport where there's an NDB approach and a VOR approach, and no vectors to final. And he checks on the frequency just as happy as can be in the dark, and he tells me he's got some ice, and he has to do this NDB with the procedure turn. He does it. I clear him for approach, and I tell him change to advisory frequency and report canceling IFR. And he does all that, and I wait, and it's just horrible waiting for these cancellations sometimes. And all of a sudden he comes on the frequency, and he's on a missed approach. And now he's scared because he's picked up a huge amount of ice. And he comes off and he says, I'm in trouble, essentially. He didn't say that, didn't declare an emergency. But he told me he had a whole bunch of ice, I forget his term, and I knew he was in trouble. And I knew he had people on board, and I knew those people. And he needed to get into that airport. He couldn't make it to Des Moines. It was too far away. And so I did what was probably illegal. I didn't care. We couldn't vector to that approach because there was no final approach course depicted at that airport. And I told him, I said, I'm going to vector your final. And I vectored him around. I just drew an imaginary final approach course to the VOR approach. I didn't bother with the NDB. And I vectored him to the final. It was kind of almost a surveillance approach to the final. And I told him, you're on final. Here's where you are exactly. And I changed him to advisory. And I said, when you get on the ground, call me. You know, call flight service, call me. And he disappeared off the radar scope, non-radar, and it just went dark. I mean, silence. And I waited and waited and waited and waited. This was before cell phones. And I thought he was dead. And so I called the soup, and I said, I think I'd lost him. And I knew the guy. And we started the procedures to find out, to send the sheriff out there. Next thing you know, the phone rings, and the TRACON, it's him. He couldn't find the key to get to the room where the pay phone was. Didn't have a dime. Had to go back and find a dime or a quarter, whatever it was, to make the call. But he was alive. He'd made it. But it was one ugly night.
Man, nice work. But putting all the cards on the table here, what about the times you just plain screwed up?
How much time we got? All right. Narrow it down to the top 10?
Give me the top two.
Top two. The worst one is when I was just checked out in Des Moines back in the early 80s. I'd come from California. I was already a journeyman controller. And I vectored a guy around, he was in a 3,000-foot MVA, minimum vectoring altitude, on a vectoring for approach, IFR, to a satellite. Had several people on vectors up there. And I left him at 3,000 feet in the MVA for 3,000. But nearby was an MVA for 4,000 because of TV towers. And I knew about them. Everybody knew about them. They were depicted by a little V shape on the scope. And I had three guys on vectors. And I got distracted by a non-radar, we'll call it a handoff, or a non-radar inbound on a P-3 that was having trouble with the radios and whatnot. So I got distracted with this Navy flight coming into Des Moines. And while I was distracted, this guy on my vectors drifted into the 4,000-foot MVA. The winds aloft were a lot stronger than I thought. And he went right between the TV towers. There were three of them up there that stick 2,000 feet above the ground. Went right between them in the clouds. And next thing I hear is him screaming at me. Not that he hit them, he lived. But he was quite upset. And when I suddenly realized my mistake, as I'm listening to him yelling at me, I can hear the conflict, a low-altitude alert going off. The big horn in the room was screaming, ah, 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 ah. And I couldn't believe I'd made a mistake. It just made me literally sick. And, of course, I was relieved. I was decertified, as anybody is when they have what's called a deal, and retrained for a week. And as it turned out, it was my mistake, my complete mistake, just my ignorance and inexperience, and wasn't doing a good scan on the scope like an instrument pilot should be scanning his panel. You don't just stare at one thing, and I got distracted by one thing. And out of that came a new mapping, and out of that came a new way I worked traffic and improved my scan. So I was lucky that he wasn't killed, but it led to better things.
How did he know he went between two towers if he was solid?
He saw flashing red lights in the clouds in his peripheral vision.
Oh.
He saw the towers go by.
In the clouds.
They went by, and I guess there was enough visibility that he saw them go past his wingtip and thought, yeah, I wonder what that is. And he knew where he was, but not well enough. And that's why I always tell pilots, first of all, don't trust ATC. And when you're on a vector, you better know what's around you. And don't just blindly trust the controller knows what's going on. I don't care how good you think they are. Mistakes happen, and guess who meets, you know, who eats the granite, who eats the tower at this point? It's the pilot that suffers. The other one, a little less dangerous, is I was working one day, and I was vectoring two airplanes. And you make your biggest mistakes when you only have one or two airplanes. And I had a Merlin, I think it was, or I don't know, a Bondurani or something, a turboprop, and I had a 737. And I got what's called jet-itis. I had two guys coming in to the same airport, and I just assumed that the jet would be first. Well, once they're below 10,000 feet, a 737 slows down quite a bit, and the old bandits, the turboprop, they keep going because they're commuters. They don't care. And I kept slowing this bandit and turning him away and slowing and turning and slowing and turning him. And finally, I got the slow 737 who kept dying on me airspeed-wise. I got him in and on cleared visual onto the tower. And I shipped in the tower, and then I told the commuter guy, look for the 737. He said, oh, yeah, we've been watching him for miles. We should have been first. And, you know, it was a bit of an attitude, but I said, you know, you're absolutely right. I screwed up. I apologize, and I'm sorry. And the guy said, oh, I didn't mean to make you apologize. No, I owe you one. I owe you one. Ship in the tower. Later on, when I saw his flight plan outbound, I called the tower. I said, give him any runway he wants. Give him any on-course heading he wants. Give him any altitude he wants. On he goes. You got to admit your mistakes.
What were your favorite times as a controller?
Midnight shifts were the best time to be a controller, although I hate working midnight shifts because of a lack of sleep, and believe me, the FAA has been blind to this for years. When controllers work midnight shifts, they are zombies by the time they're at the end of the shift, and usually at the end of the shift is when you're busiest, and so some of the worst moments were at the end of a midnight shift before the relief came in, when the rush started, and I was by myself. But earlier in a midnight shift, it's kind of cool because there's no management there. And you're by yourself or with somebody else, maybe. And the traffic is all professional. And the last of the airlines go away. The military's done for the day. And then the freight dogs come in. And the freight dogs are the best IFR pilots out there for controllers because they fly their airplanes the best. They give you the short approaches. They want the slam dunk. They want the turn at the marker. They can give you any speed you want. I've seen 310s, Cessna 310s, do amazing things. And they all know each other, and they all converge on the airport at the same time from all over the scope, Lears, 310, Mitsubishis, everything. And they have the flick. And IFR pilots who have the flick understand what's going on in the big sky around them, can work themselves into it. And these guys would check on frequency, and they would spell out what they want. And it would work in your plan real easily. And they would report the airport in sight 60 miles out, literally. And so it was so cool because they'd check on with the ATIS, airport in sight, request runway, whatever, and your transmission to them would be, for a visual approach, would be, Roger, cleared visual approach, runway 5, clear to land, taxi to ramp, here's your outbound clearance, clear to Denver, as filed, climb, maintain 10, expect 230, 10 minutes after departure, departure frequency, this one, squawk such and such, advise, ready to taxi. And they're still 60 miles away. And it was just cool. And they would do it. You just watch them. And they'd slide in there. Or they'd, or you'd say, he'd report the airport in sight. And I'd, do you see your company out there on 12? You know, runway 12? Yeah, I got him. We'll get ahead of him. Okay. Clear visual. Other guy. Follow him. Go this, this, this. And they'd all just slide in. Boom, 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 boom. And they were just great. It was great to fly with them, too. We'd get jump seat rides occasionally with them. And they were just a hoot to fly with. So the midnight shifts were exciting. And, they're fun to work. The easiest airplane, easiest of all airplanes I've ever worked, was Air Force One. I've worked the old 707 Air Force One and 747 with the E4 707. And the reason is they own the airspace. Everything's gone. It's sterilized. And they come in, and they always had the best navigation equipment, and they got whatever they wanted, whatever runway they wanted. They had their time schedule, and they just slid right in. Just said, clear to approach, clear to land. And it was great. Of the ones I worked, I remember Reagan's Air Force One was probably the most efficient. They were always on time. They always left on time. There was never a delay. Bush's, the first Bush, was the same way. And the worst was Clinton's Air Force One. It was always late. It was always delayed. It always tied up the ramp. And there was always another photo op going on right below the tower there. It just delayed, delayed, delayed. We'd have to do all this coordinating to keep the airspace closed for a while. But they were fun.
You're a retired controller, but you're an active pilot and a flight instructor. What advice do you have for pilots when working with ATC?
It's rumored that ATC will change, that things will go high-tech, ABS, ADS-B will change things, RNP, all these kind of fancy words and acronyms. It still comes down to one pilot talking to one controller. I don't care where you are. You're still making that human contact. So communication is highly important regardless of the airspace. You should know the airspace. Even if you've never been there before, the more you know about the airspace, the better you off you'll be. The more you know about the culture of that facility, how they like their flow, how they react, how they speak, the better off you'll be. 2 years ago, I flew my biplane out to California. It's an open cockpit biplane. And it had a radio transponder. You know, GPS, the open cockpit, it's really hard to change frequencies and read a map and things like that. And I was going to Los Angeles, hadn't been in there in decades. So I stopped outside of Palm Springs at Banning Pass, at the airport there, nice little airport, and I got the local terminal chart, and I asked the local pilots, how do you get around through this airspace VFR over to Van Nuys? And I programmed the GPS for the VFR routes, and then I took off. And I called SoCal Approach, open cockpit. They couldn't hear me very well, so I had to stick my head below the windscreen to yell into the microphone. They gave me the squawk, and I started following this. And the guy said, go over to Montario, and then I think over to Roosevelt, something like that. I didn't know where these places were, so I pulled out my chart that I had there. It was open cockpit, and instantly the chart ripped in half and out of my hands and disappeared. So I thought, oh, great. But I'm a controller. I know what they want. So I just fessed up. You know, I'm an Iowa kid. I'm kind of unfamiliar with all your highways. If you tell me a highway, when they said follow the 405 or follow the Ventura Expressway or whatever, I said, okay, verify that's this one right below me and that sort of thing. You just got to work with them a little bit when you're dealing with ATC. You gotta speak clearly and confess when you don't understand and say what you want. For instance, when you want practice approaches, which is a lot of what a controller works with at an approach control, people want to practice approach, students, flight instructors, and they get on the frequency, and they don't spell out what they want. You can do practice approaches VFR or IFR. If it's a VFR day, you might get better service asking for a VFR practice approach. You'll get the same approach. You just won't get the IFR separation. You'll get a modified separation once you're cleared for the approach. So it depends on how much of that you actually need. Always ask if you want the procedure turn or vectors. Nothing will irritate a controller faster, approach controller, than you're asking for a practice approach and he starts vectoring for the sequence, and he clears his approach, and then you key up and say, oh, by the way, we're doing the procedure turn. Well, no, you're not. You just got vector to final. So you got to understand the difference between vector to final, procedure turn, and what's expected. Don't be pushy. I mean, it's a tough thing to talk in a frequency, request something, and not be pushy about it. All controllers know that you want something or a series of things, but if you become known as a PETA, P-E-T-A, you ever heard that term? Pain in the ass. So if you get known as that with a controller, you're always going to be number two. You're always going to be the tiebreaker. Even if there's only one airplane and you're it, you're going to be number two. Every controller has at least one airplane that when they hear the call sign, that airplane becomes number two. I had a Mitsubishi pilot and a Lear pilot, I won't say their call signs from years ago. They were always number two. I would always find somebody to put in front because they were always irritating, pushy, and a nuisance. And they always got penalty vectors. Those are some of the sad secrets of ATC.
Hey, if people want to find more of your current writing and radio work, where would they look?
The easiest way would just be go to my website, which is my name, paulburge.com. And that links from that over to my old radio show, Rejection Slip Theater, and we have the podcast available there and the TV show. And in fact, there's even a video IPTV we did last year about flying the Marquardt over Iowa, so they can go look at that. And some of my novels and stuff are online for anybody to read for free, plus my police record. You took that off. Never mind.
Thanks so much, Paul. I appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, you're quite welcome, Jeff.
To learn more about this and other topics of interest to accomplished pilots, and specifically about instrument flight, log on to www.ifr-magazine.com. Comments on this audiocast welcome at audionews@avweb.com.